Okay. Hare Krishna. So this is nice and cozy. We're going to speak about Govardhan, Krishna's pastime of lifting Govardhan Hill. And first of all, very briefly explain what happened, as if you don't know. And then talk about some of the lessons to be learned. Perhaps the first point to make is that Krishna, Krishna's activities are called Leela, which is often translated pastime. The idea is that from the philosophical point of view, there is a great distinction between freedom and necessity. In a sense, freedom and necessity are opposite concepts. That, in other words, if I have to do something, I'm not doing it freely. I may not be choosing to do it. I'm being forced to do it. So, for example, if you consider material objects, like if you take a material object, say an ordinary thing. Oh, my God. If you take an object and drop it, let's say and you're within the Earth's atmosphere and everything, and it falls according to the law of gravity. Like if I drop this paper, the paper really doesn't have a choice to fall or not fall. This paper is completely subject to the laws of nature. So when something happens necessarily, it doesn't happen freely. That's the point I want to make. And so the activities of God are pastimes in the sense that whatever, because God is all-powerful, whatever Krishna does, he does freely and not out of necessity. It's the nature of God that there's no law above God that can force him to act in a particular way. We, in our own lives, are a combination of freedom and necessity. For example, we're born in bodies. The fact that our bodies are aging, we can't really stop despite all the heroic attempts of cosmetic surgery. Or, for example, we're subject to so many different laws of nature, like the law of gravity. We have to drink water or something containing water and eat food to keep our bodies alive. So there are so many laws which are over us. There are so many forces in the universe which force us to exist or act in a certain way. At the same time, we have freedom. At the same time, we have the freedom to make choices, to choose to do something or to choose not to do something. We can choose mental acts, speech acts, or actual bodily activities. So we are a combination of freedom and necessity, whereas God is pure freedom. And the only limits on God are those he places upon himself. For example, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that he freely chooses to reciprocate with other souls. In other words, to treat other souls fairly. Even though Krishna is all-powerful and could be the worst possible tyrant, still, God chooses to treat other souls fairly. So he imposes upon himself that boundary. Now, the word Leela, which refers to Krishna's activities, is a word which specifically emphasizes or denotes and connotes and notes that whatever Krishna is doing, he's doing freely. He's doing it out of his own free will. So that's something on the word Leela. Now, this particular Leela, which Krishna performed very briefly, he was a young boy living in the village of Vrindavan. There's a certain dramatic appeal to a great hero growing up in a small town. I mean, Superman, it worked for Superman, I mean, in terms of dramatic appeal. He grew up in, was it Smallville or, you know, just farm, some little farm town or something, and then he became Superman. So it has its appeal. So similarly, Krishna grew up in Smallville, Vrindavan. He grew up in this little town. He was a young boy, even though he was Krishna. And Krishna appeared in this world thousands of years ago within a culture in which the worship of nature gods was very common. In fact, if you look at all pre-industrial civilizations, you'll find that in different ways, there is a tendency to worship the forces of nature in different ways. There's a strong propensity. So in Krishna's own village, people were preparing to offer a sacrifice to Indra. Indra is the god of rain and thunder in Vedic culture, Zeus in Greek culture. Actually, the word Zeus is from Sanskrit, Zeus. Anyway, I won't go into the historical linguistics, but the words are related. Jupiter, which is Sanskrit, by the way, Ju means heaven, and Peter means father, like Pita, so Jupiter means the father of heaven. So Jupiter in the Roman civilization, and Zeus, and Indra. Now, one problem is that because most of us grew up in at least what was traditionally a monotheistic culture, in which worship is reserved for one supreme god, we may have the tendency to think that people in ancient times were kind of primitive and just not very bright because they worshiped many gods. However, if you study India, especially, let's say, traditional ancient India, even if you study, let's say, Roman civilization or Greek civilization, people did not think of the nature gods as holy, all-powerful gods. They more or less understood they were paying their taxes. So the psychology, the religious psychology, which tends to operate in these, you could say, polytheistic cultures, was not that stupid as it may sound to us today, because they understood. I caused that to happen just by mental energy. So they actually understood that in the universe there is a cosmic administration and you have to pay taxes. I mean, most of us will never see the people that receive our tax money. Of course, most devotees never pay taxes. That's another topic. But when we pay taxes, even let's say if you go buy something in a store and pay sales tax, you never see to whom the tax goes. It's just, you just assume there's some administration and the tax goes there so that the people can do what bureaucrats do best, waste your money. So similarly, if you look at ancient civilizations like in India, they were paying their taxes to those who manage nature. Now Krishna wanted to make a point. Krishna, seeing his family and his village, his father, who was the village chief, preparing the sacrifice, wanted to make a point. The point being the monotheism. Krishna wanted to make the point of monotheism. And therefore he basically argued to his father that there's no need to engage in this, even paying taxes to the rulers of nature, not to speak of having any real religious sentiment toward them, because in fact there really is one God, and if you establish an appropriate relationship with that God, then you don't have to do the other stuff. Now, so what Krishna did is he urged his father, in doing so, Krishna actually gave a very sophisticated philosophical argument, which devotees don't often look at. So we know, for those of you who know the Bhagavatam, we know sort of very generally that he argued karma mimamsa philosophy or something like that. But actually, if you look at this argument, which is in 10th canto, chapter 24, verses approximately 13, 23, about 11 verses, it's a very sophisticated and very modern philosophical argument on why you don't have to worship the nature gods. And I don't know if I have time before the hook comes out, the bell rings, and I'm unceremoniously dragged away, but if I have time to go over that. So what Krishna did is he convinced his father not to offer this sacrifice to Indra, not to pay the cosmic taxes, knowing that Indra would get really mad and try to do something about it, and Krishna's, in the Bhagavatam, the Sanskrit says Krishna wanted to break the pride that even these cosmic administrators, these governors of nature, they're not God, capital G, they're God with a small g, not a capital G, and they're also not perfectly holy beings. They sometimes have, you know, need their own cosmic anger management courses and things. And they sometimes have issues. They're not perfect souls. They're very great souls. They're pious souls, but not spiritually perfect. And therefore, sometimes their behavior and even their character can be somewhat flawed. And this is one of the points that's brought out in the Bhagavatam. By the way, a little historical background. At the time that Krishna performed this pastime, There was a much older sacred text already in existence, which is referred to, and that is the Rig Veda and other Vedas. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, when he speaks Bhagavad Gita, he refers to this much older stratum of sacred texts, the Vedas. And in the Rig Veda, which is the main text, most of the verses numerically are actually dedicated to Indra. And so Krishna appeared in a civilization in which the oldest and, in a sense, most influential sacred texts were emphasizing the worship of these nature gods rather than any type of serious spiritual or philosophical monotheism. So that was the historical background. So Krishna wanted to bring up this point. So he told his father not to worship Indra. Indra, predictably, got very angry and decided to teach them a lesson. Not actually teach the world a lesson by destroying Krishna's village. That the Krishna was impudent, a usurper, and he was going to teach the world a lesson by destroying this village. Tough love. So he sent these ferocious clouds, these sort of like extremely violent clouds. I mean, there have been so many floods just... Bless you. Hare Krishna. So, just in the Mexican state of Tabasco, which it will be forever remembered for the production of sauce, in the Mexican state of Tabasco, these very bad floods, and most of the state was underwater, and floods can be very serious. I mean, mudslides, floods are very serious, lethal events when they get to a certain level. So anyway, Indra created this, really, this deadly flood, and Krishna then went to this big hill or mountain, small mountain, big hill, and Govardhan, and lifted it up and held it aloft with the little finger of his left hand, which was kind of like, sort of, you could say, making a gesture toward Indra. Holding up this mountain with the little finger of his left hand, and the entire village gathered under this mountain and was protected and saved, and Indra was completely thwarted. Indra eventually got it. He understood that something has gone seriously wrong here. And he came and apologized and submitted himself to what he now understood to be a much higher authority than himself, namely God. So that's basically what happened. So I've gone over the point of Krishna establishing monotheism versus a type of polytheism or the worship of many gods, small g. Another important lesson from this story is that Krishna saves his devotees. If you look at human religion all over the world throughout history, it's very clear that one of the main needs that people have sought to fulfill in the practice of religion throughout the world, in all different kinds of religions, is that people have sought to gain for themselves safety and protection in what they perceive to be a dangerous world. Now, this is not simply a figment of the collective imagination of humanity. Because actually, if you look at the history of the world, for human beings, the death rate is a very solid 100%. They say no one bats 1,000, but death does bat 1,000. So, I saw a bumper sticker that's, you know, baseball. It said, nature bats last. Anyway, so the death rate throughout history has been a very solid 100%. And that's serious. I mean, it seems to me that despite the attempt by some people to show a certain existential bravado and say, like, well, I don't care about death. You know, I'm not afraid of death. Like, when you go, you go. Despite this bravado, I think most people are just faking it, that talk this way, the people that are kind of reckless in this way. They're just sort of, you know, showing off, and when death really comes, they're not quite as courageous as all that. And I think that it follows also logically that you cannot devalue death without devaluing life. In other words, if you have something, namely life, and then you have something else which destroys it, if the destruction of something has no negative value, that thing had no positive value. If someone, let's say someone, God forbid, harms someone in your family, if that doesn't bother you, if you think, hey, that was no big loss, obviously you didn't value that person very much. If you lose your health and you think, well, that's trivial, that means you didn't value your health that much. You cannot devalue the loss of something without devaluing that thing itself. So to say that death does not have a significant negative value is to say logically that life does not have a significant positive value. So before people like sort of show their bravado, like I don't care about death, they should think it through. Although thinking is sort of an endangered activity in the modern world. So therefore, if you study the history of religion, people have always sought, they've always tried through all kinds of religious activities throughout history to protect themselves, to get security and safety. And that's natural. You could say that it's just a crutch, but actually, what if you're really crippled? And what if the only way you can walk is with a crutch? And in terms of a crutch, for atheists, the absurd presumption of thinking there is no God, and it is philosophically absurd to say there's no God, but I won't go into that now, is actually a psychological crutch that holds up one's vanity, one's self-centeredness. So it's like, who's got the crutch? So you can either choose the using a crutch to hold up, to bolster your own ego and vanity and self and sort of irrational self-centeredness, because we're not really the center of anything. Or you can take the helping hand of God and actually make spiritual progress and go toward enlightenment. But either way, you're taking help. So Krishna saved his devotees. And that's significant. It is a very dangerous world. Even in these so-called first world countries, although America has many second and third world type areas in it. But even in America, where everything's supposed to work properly, we know there's danger everywhere. There's all kinds of problems. If you actually live here, you know it's not Camelot. And there's real danger everywhere. So to want to appeal to want the protection of an all-powerful, wise, and merciful God simply shows that someone has common sense and a brain in their head. And that's what this story actually demonstrates, that Krishna saves his devotees. Moving right along here, a few points. Another thing is that another important thing, let's see, I have another few minutes, that this story demonstrates, this his story demonstrates, is that Krishna is infinitely cool, in the colloquial sense of the word. Because, in other words, Krishna is not just mechanical and functional, like, okay, I want to establish monotheism, so I'll just sort of drag Indra here and overpower him and then issue edicts or protect people. Just, in other words, Krishna is not simply performing functions. He's doing it with real pizzazz. He's doing it with real style, real elegance, with an incredible sense of theater. And this is something which is actually goes to the very nature of God. He's not merely mechanically functional. He doesn't just get jobs done. He's an artist. He's an artist. He's got the most incredible style. The Bhagavatam teaches this all the time, that Krishna is actually theatrical. He's artistic. If you look at the universe, apart from other things you could say about it, it is also a universe of art. If you look very closely at snowflakes, water crystals, just a cell, if you take any aspect of the world, a galaxy, and look at it, everywhere in the universe you find art. It is a universe of art. And therefore the creator is not merely an engineer, the creator is an artist. If you look actually at blown up pictures of insects, you'd almost think the creator was on LSD or something, because if you've ever actually looked at like insects, it's, I don't know what else to say, it's very psychedelic. It's like, it like goes way, way beyond the bar scene in Star Wars. So another aspect of this whole pastime, the way Krishna brought this about, is that he's an incredible artist. He has an infinite sense of drama, of style. And he doesn't simply perform a function, but he does it in a beautiful, elegant way so that the world forever after can enjoy these stories. And that's the nature of God. And that's our nature. Because God is ultimately personal. If someone is pursuing a spiritual path in which they want to obliterate or literally annihilate their personal existence, I think that... talk about low self-esteem. If you think that the best thing you can do with your personal nature is to destroy it, I mean, there's some kind of self-esteem issue here. It's the word annihilate, the word nihil in Latin means, of course, nothing. So to annihilate, annihilate literally means to make nothing. So to be a person, to be able to love and be loved, to be able to sing and dance, to be able to appreciate beauty, to be able to be beautiful, to have personal relationships, to do everything that you can do as a person, to think that I want to destroy all that. I want to kill singing. I want to kill dancing. I want to kill beauty. I want to kill relationships. I want to kill falling in love. I want to kill the beauty of nature. I want to kill poetry. I want to kill music. And that's what enlightenment is, to destroy all of this. I mean, if you think about it carefully, I think you can understand why Lord Chaitanya said that the impersonal concept of God actually destroys life. It really ruins everything. So therefore, the good news here is that enlightenment does not involve destroying everything which is precious and beautiful in personal life, but rather purifying personal life, bringing it to its most exalted, perfect state, where you can fall in love and be in love forever, as opposed to what happens down here. So that's the good news, that there actually is a supreme personal God. And therefore, all these aspects of personal life, music and poetry and art and falling in love and having relationships, friendship, using your intelligence, appreciating nature, these things are all eternal. But to understand, but to achieve this eternal personal life, we have to become completely free of selfishness and obnoxiousness. I mean, because it's like, basically, all you have to do to go back to the spiritual world is stop being obnoxious. Because if you think about it, that's really all it is. That's the short, that's the simple version of it. Because, I mean, all of us, I mean, actually I said you. I mean, if you point at someone, you got three fingers pointing at yourself. You can get around that by pointing like this. Because that way you have three fingers pointing at them. But anyway, if you think about it, Krishna created this world. Krishna created this world, and he loves us. And so if we respond to this, to all these gifts by shoplifting, basically, trying to enjoy the world without God, trying to take things for ourselves, having no gratitude toward a person that gives us our own existence, refusing to have a serious relationship with someone who's all attractive just because I would rather be self-centered in a completely irrational way. I mean, there's something clinically insane about being self-centered because we're not the center. So therefore, the only thing, the only obstacle to our spiritual perfection is that we have to not be jerks. I mean, basically, just be good, virtuous persons. Be grateful for what we've been given and accept a loving relationship with those who are most worthy of our love. And we should do this not merely because if we don't, the all-merciful God will torture us forever with no chance of parole, but rather because we're just cheating ourselves. It's like if there's a great party going on down the street and for some crazy reason you refuse to go, it's like you're not hurting the people at the party. They're having a great time. So there is a great eternal party going on in the spiritual world, and you're invited. That's it. So Krishna comes down to show us these pastimes and invite us, attract us to our real life under the wire. So we have 2 minutes. Any questions on these points?
I have a question.
Yes.
Well,
this gentleman broke his kneecap. How is that a spiritual opportunity? For one thing, I mean, not that we want you to have broken your kneecap, but it does show you and us that the body is imperfect and that we should certainly take care of our body, but we can't ultimately put our highest hopes in the body. We can't be taking shelter. That's not our ultimate shelter, the body. Take care of it. Do the best you can, but realize that your real hope, your real future is not the body.
Sure.
And get well soon. So anything else? What? Okay, that's time. So thank you all very much for coming, and Hare Krishna.